Brand name or generic drugs? Generics or brand name drugs? Consumers might save money, drug companies win. Either way, the EpiPen saga continues from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 29th of August. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. Today in, wow, that didn't take long, did it? This news, the drug maker Mylan has responded once again to the outrage over the price increase of its flagship product, the EpiPen. You remember last week, the company offered discount coupons. Today, a generic version of the EpiPen that'll sell for half of the branded item's full price. Good PR, yes, sure, if that's your thing. Also, though, a savvy business decision that's going to help Mylan maximize its EpiPen profits. From the help desk at WHYY, here's Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein to get us going.
So the math seems pretty simple. Mylan says in the next few weeks, it'll introduce a two-pack of EpiPens for $300, 50% cheaper than the identical branded product. But even if everybody starts buying the cheap stuff, the company may still come out ahead. University of Chicago economist Rena Conti says that's because the company offers lots of discounts and rebates on the branded drug.
Mylan is claiming that they're going to cut out all of those discounts and rebates. That means that Mylan's net price may actually not change that much and may even go up.
Mylan did not return a call seeking comment. The company hopes today's news helps it slide out of the spotlight after making headlines for jacking up the price of EpiPens by more than 500%. The life-saving product treats severe allergic reactions. But this could be a really good deal for Mylan. Harvard physician Aaron Kesselheim says launching its own generic could scare off any would-be competitors.
The strategy here is to try to delay full, broad generic competition as long as possible and to maintain some fraction of the generic market for themselves.
Unintentionally, doctors may actually help Mylan corner the generic market. Dr. Keely Godwin practices outside of Raleigh, North Carolina.
We're in a rush and we're trying to get things done. And so doctors are a little bit lazy when they do that stuff. And so there we go. We write the easy thing that we know.
In other words, docs will keep prescribing Mylan products, whether it's the branded EpiPen or its generic version. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
One hates to pry, but what'd you have for breakfast? Coffee, maybe? Tea, perhaps? Toast or cereal or something? Was there any orange juice in there, though? Chances are not, and if there was, it almost certainly wasn't the kind that comes frozen from concentrate. You know, the kind where you mix the water in? Therein lies part of the problem that orange growers are facing right now, a problem that is affecting orange futures trading as well. Julie Warnow writes about the orange market in the Wall Street Journal today. Julie, thanks for coming on.
Good to be here.
So what, pray tell, has happened to the frozen orange juice concentrate market? Because it used to be, I mean, it's like my childhood, man. You take that out of the freezer and boom, you got OJ.
Right. It's like the first thing that you learn how to make
right.
as a child.
Right.
This is a market, this little market, that is literally fighting to survive. First of all, people aren't drinking as much frozen right. concentrated orange juice as they used to. I don't know when the last time you had a glass was.
Couldn't tell you.
You know, there's a huge trend now toward better nutrition and less sugar and premium ingredients and less processed food. And none of those describes frozen concentrated right. orange juice. We also have disease that yeah. is just ripping apart the orange groves in Florida.
This is the greening thing, right?
That's right. I mean, essentially, if you think about it, it's this disease that kind of works its way up through the tree, almost like heart disease, and the fruit just drops before it's ripe. And so it's an incurable bacterial disease.
Talk to me for a minute then about sort of the wider market repercussions, right? Because you've got this frozen orange juice concentrate futures market that has withered. You've got the actual juice market, which is in some trouble. I mean, there's a whole lot going on here.
Right. Well, essentially what's happened is it's turning this market that used to be a pretty thriving market, a pretty exciting market, into a bit of a ghost town. So you'll see things. Usually when you follow markets, you'll see that if something fundamentally is happening, like if mm-hmm. there was a hurricane, for instance, that, you know, the market would go up or down. And this market seems to sort of just gyrate based on, you know, the whims of speculators at this point.
What happens to the bigger orange juice market in Florida then? Because that is just a huge part of that state's economy. And here it is, I mean, literally dying on the tree.
yeah, there's a lot of movement afoot there. They're working with scientists. They're even they're trying to create, you know, genetically modified oranges. But the problem is that at this point, a lot of these citrus growers are just abandoning their groves. There's 130,000 plus acres in Florida that are just it's just abandoned land. And so it's a problem.
Yeah. there's a quote in your piece from a grower in Central Florida. He says, citrus isn't really making anybody anything right now. And that's a recipe for a market that's not going to be around.
Yeah. I mean, these citrus growers have been through a lot over many years. I mean, I talked to a guy in the 80s, his groves froze. There's a huge freeze across Florida. They replanted everything a few years later. The same thing happened. They've been through hurricanes. A lot of them just aren't giving up. But the problem is with this particular disease, what it literally leads to is fewer oranges, right? So that's less money that you're producing right. per tree. And then you also have to pay a ton of money for new trees and pesticides. And so they're just not making those margins.
Hmm. Julia Warnow writes in the Wall Street Journal today about the frozen concentrated orange juice market, which is in some trouble. Julie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street this Monday, traders took another look at Janet Yellen's speech from last Friday out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And then they thought about the August jobs report that's coming this Friday and set about wrapping up August on a high note. It looks like we'll have the details when we do the numbers. States have been cutting their jail and prison populations a lot over the past couple of years. But even with fewer prisoners, you do still need prison guards, which is where the story is, because it's a tough job. The hours are long, the pay is low, conditions are often difficult, and not a whole lot of people want to do it. So just about every state has a shortage, especially in Florida, which has lost 11,000 corrections officers. Lisa Roth went down to see what's going on.
3 years ago, Lisa Murray quit her job as a corrections officer in a Florida state prison. And she took a new job as a corrections officer at a county jail. It was a lower-ranked position, but it paid a lot more. She liked the old job. She just couldn't afford to keep it.
To be honest, I was close to losing my house. There were times that I couldn't afford to put food in my refrigerator.
By the second year in her new job, she had nearly doubled her old salary. And she was still doing essentially the same thing, which is supervising inmates, though the hours are different.
I always worked days when I was with the state because I had seniority. But coming here, since I have no seniority, I'm on nights.
We're sitting in front of the jail where she now works. It's hot and humid, even though it's dark out. It's really quiet, except for the air conditioner buzz and the bugs. Officers all over the state are leaving to take all kinds of jobs. The starting salary in a state prison is $28,000. And officers haven't gotten a substantial raise in years. Florida has one of the biggest prison populations in the country and some of the lowest starting salaries of any state. Some union leaders and lawmakers say the shortage puts officers in danger.
Franklin Correctional Institution is under lockdown after a group of inmates stopped listening to orders over the weekend.
As the local ABC affiliate WTXL reported, there have been cases of unrest in the state prisons, at least three just this year. The state used to have more correctional officers, so an officer could leave a post to deal with an inmate and there would still be enough staffing on the floor.
We don't have those positions anymore to do that.
Julie Jones, the Secretary of Corrections, knows the state needs more officers. In January, she told the legislature's Criminal Justice Committee that staffing levels were too low during one of those incidents.
So were we staffed to a critical complement? Yes. Were we appropriately staffed, sir? No.
She says what's happened is that crisis staffing levels have simply become the norm. Lisa Murray, the former state prison officer, says as a lieutenant in the state prison, she had to find ways to cut corners.
Okay, well, what am I going to leave unmanned? I can't leave a dorm, but, you know, where a dorm is supposed to have two, maybe three people, I've got one.
That's dangerous. It's also demoralizing because officers end up working harder and longer. And sometimes they have to do mandatory overtime at the last minute.
10 minutes, maybe. And that's it. That's all the warning you get.
That's Daniel Talita. He quit his job as a state corrections officer to become a cable guy at Comcast. I talked to him in a convenience store near his house in Naples. He says it's not the salary that makes it worthwhile, since he's only earning about $1 an hour more than he was. But he gets raises and bonuses. And more important, he's not commuting 3 hours a day. He works days, and there's no mandatory overtime.
I am telling you, if you were due to leave at 8 o'clock, you would wind up at 7:50 getting that phone call, and the captain would tell you, oh, you gotta work a double. It might happen twice a week.
The Department of Corrections says it's planning to hire 4,000 new officers by this time next year to fill those empty positions and to replace the officers who keep quitting. In Naples, Florida, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Nary a week has gone by this summer without news of some kind of computer hack. Everything from a celebrity social media account to the Democratic National Committee or even the National Security Agency. All of this is just the latest evolution of a field once known as cybernetics, a term coined in the middle of the last century to refer to machines, smart machines really, and how they fit into the systems of our lives. It's also the operative word and title of Thomas Ridd's new book. He's a professor at King's College London. The book is called Rise of the Machines, A Cybernetic History. Professor, welcome to the program.
Hello, pleasure.
I wanted to frame this book more in terms of the sort of the economic policy discussions and the political discussions that we are having today. And I want to start with a quote from this book. John Kennedy, at a press conference in 1962, he says, I regard it as the major domestic challenge, really, of the 1960s to maintain full employment at a time when automation, of course, is replacing workers. It is not new, this idea that the robots are going to steal our jobs, right?
This idea that robots could take over jobs and dignity at the workplace is an old idea. It dates back to the early 60s, late 1950s even, at least. And the fear that robots would take over came first as a hope, because first it was a good thing, automation, and then very quickly the pessimism and the fear.
But it's interesting because, you know, you say, just talking about us trying to figure out what the future was going to bring, you end the book by saying futurists don't always get the future wrong, but they almost always get the speed, the scale, and the shape of the change that is coming wrong.
We have this tendency to overestimate how quickly technical change will come. Now, the problem is that in the early 2000s, the change, think of smartphones and touch screens, came indeed very quickly. And so we are spoiled. We think it will just continue in that speed, technical change. But I think that is probably not the case. History tells us that probably we're looking at a period of slowing down of technological change at this point.
Why do you say that?
Well, because the debate right now has all the trappings of really overstating both hope and fear of cyber. You can say, okay, the West Coast in the United States, Silicon Valley, they tend to be too optimistic. And parts of the East Coast, and thinking of the intelligence community and the security establishment in D.C., they tend to be too pessimistic. It's freedom against war, cyber hope against cyber war, if you like.
We're already there, though, this idea of cyber war. Since you mentioned the intelligence community on the East Coast, I mean, the last, you know, 3 weeks or a month with the hacks of the Democratic National Committee, and I mean, it is already happening, but only now coming to general public attention.
Indeed. So what I'm trying to do in the book is portray the first big cyber attack against the United States government, military, and indeed private sector. And it started exactly 20 years ago in 1996. And it turned out at the time already to be a Russian attack. Now, it is remarkable that the exact same adversary has simply evolved since then. The first cyber war, if you like, has never stopped. But the way we imagined it for those 2 decades was completely different from what actually happened. It wasn't planes falling from the sky or, you know, chemical factories exploding. It turned out to be spying, and now it turns out to be somebody trying to clandestinely influence a U.S. election by tricking journalists, by tricking politicians, by tricking normal people to believe things that the other side wants them to believe.
Thomas Ridd is a professor at King's College London. His book about the subject at hand is called Rise of the Machines. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up.
You want to see someone getting on a Harley Davidson, tearing up the street, because you couldn't do it before.
Seniors with money to burn. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 107 points on this last Monday in August. That's a 0.5%, 18,502. The NASDAQ added 13 points, 0.25%, 52.32. The S&P 500 up 11 points, about a 0.5%, 21.80. We told you about the decision by Mylan, the EpiPen maker, to create its own generic. Mylan shot up 0.4%. Get it? Shot. Teva Pharmaceuticals, that tried to acquire Mylan last year, by the by, is also developing its own generic EpiPen. Down 0.6%. You do have to wonder what the CEO of that company is thinking now. Probably, phew. Pharmaceutical giant Merck gained 0.25%. Just throw another name in there. In the high-stakes world of casinos, odds against Caesars Entertainment today after a U.S. judge cleared the way for a multi-billion dollar bondholder lawsuit to proceed. Caesars cut more than 15%. Las Vegas Sands boosted 0.1%. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady, as did the price, 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, any guesses how much money Disney has grossed at the box office so far this year? Just for some context, as you try to add it up in your head, we're talking Finding Dory, Zootopia, The Jungle Book, Captain America, Civil War as well, which I personally thought was meh, but which isn't really relevant right now. Yeah, it's a big number. Anyway, $2.1 billion, and it's not even Labor Day yet, but there was a time when Disney wasn't the money-making machine it is right now, when it was just kind of a place where artists could go and do some really good creative work. That Disney is the subject of a series of books by a guy named Didier Ghez. It's called They Drew As They Pleased, the latest installment of which is The Hidden Art of Disney's Musical Years, the 1940s, Part 1. Mr. Ghez, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
Put this book, this time period of Disney's evolution into context for me, would you, in the 1940s?
The 1940s at Disney are really well known as being marked by two things. The first one is the 1941 strike at the Disney studio, which was a very traumatic event for Walt Disney. And the other thing is obviously World War II, which closes down the markets that Disney had in Europe. But from a creative standpoint, the 1940s are the most creative period at the Disney studio. And those ideas that are born in the 1940s are really going to influence the Disney studio for years and years to come, until the 1950s at least, and sometimes longer than that.
It's funny that you say that, that it was full of creativity and big ideas, because I'll tell you, reading the text of this book, I mean, the pictures are great, right? The art is great to see, but the text that's in here, which is letters and correspondences and obviously your analysis, it's a little depressing. It doesn't seem like it was a great time at Disney, with layoffs and strikes and people getting furloughed and not coming back, and just grim, I guess I would say.
You're right. It's a very tough period, both for the country and for the Disney studio, because the studio is under tremendous pressure, financial pressure. What basically happens is you start the 40s, of course, with the release of Fantasia and Bambi, which are, unfortunately, big box office failures. And
Say that again, because people today think of Fantasia and Bambi and they say, oh, those are classic Disneys. But in fact, in the moment, they were not big hits.
That's right. And they cost a tremendous amount of money. From a creativity standpoint, they are absolutely fascinating. But financially, they are failures. And if it weren't for one very small movie, Dumbo, which doesn't cost much money to produce, the studio would probably have died at that time. After that, you have to wait till 1950 to see movies like Cinderella and Peter Pan and Lady and the Tramp being produced and released. But what's really interesting with those movies is that they had been in the works for most of them since the late 30s or early 40s.
Can you draw a line from, you know, the mid-40s with Walt Disney to the company as it exists today? I mean, you've taken it to the 50s, but is there a thread there that people who were there at the time would recognize in the company of today?
Yes. So in the book, you'll see quite a few pieces of artwork created in 1941 for a project which was The Little Mermaid. Uh-huh. And as you know, The Little Mermaid wasn't released until 1989. And so the artists who worked on The Little Mermaid in 1989, they discovered those drawings by that artist called Kai Nielsen, yeah, who had done all of those drawings in 1941. And he was inspired tremendously by them. And they really used that inspiration to create what became the first animated feature in the new golden age of Disney.
You got to play the long game, right? Is that the deal?
You do. You do, always. Good ideas never die at Disney.
It is the latest in a series of books on Disney's art. This one is called They Drew As They Pleased, The Hidden Art of Disney's Musical Years, The 1940s Part 1 by Didier Guez. Mr. Guez, thanks very much for your time. I enjoyed the book.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
You're going to want to check out some of the art that's in this book. Helpfully, we have some of it on our website. It's marketplace.org. A quick fact here on the way to an assertion which will get us to our next story. Here's the fact. The World Bank says 26.3% of the Japanese population is over the age of 65. That puts it number 2 in the world and by far the developed economy with the oldest population. All right, so here's the assertion that when a country ages like that, things happen in its economy, what it produces and how it produces things, which gets us to the story from Marketplace's Sally Herships.
Japan is now arguably the oldest country in the world. Last year I visited, it wasn't like you could see it walking around Tokyo or the countryside, at least not in most places. But there was one easy way to spot the shift. Just turn on the TV. What we're listening to is a commercial. Three ladies of a certain age are strolling down a city street dressed in pastel jackets, but one of them seems to be worried about something. Hiromi Yamaguchi is with Euromonitor International. Can you tell me what just happened?
So basically, these three ladies, but one of the ladies had some problem with her incontinence, and she's more of a looking for toilets rather than enjoying the time with their friends.
An ad for incontinence products for seniors. It might not sound like a big deal, but according to the Pew Research Center, in Japan, there are now more diapers produced for adults than there are for babies. But it's not just hygiene products. Yamaguchi says all kinds of companies are making changes. Stores are slowing down escalators, and you can order groceries without the internet, like over the phone. Panasonic has an entire line of products just for seniors. Mio Yamanaka is with Panasonic. She says in rural areas, a lot of Japanese live in houses with two stories and stairs.
And these people will clean up their house, stairs, holding up the vacuum cleaners. And for them, the average weight, 4 kilo, was very heavy.
That's almost 9 pounds. So Yamanaka says Panasonic created a lighter vacuum. But companies aren't just making changes to products. They also have to change the way they're advertised for a new kind of Japanese senior. Anthony Kundi is CEO of Wonderman Japan, an international advertising firm. He says traditionally in Japan, society tends to change at a snail's pace. But then 2011 hit.
Just occasionally, something happens that is so dramatic that it forces things forward.
A 7.9 earthquake in Japan.
A magnitude 9 earthquake, which shifts a whole continent 3 meters to the left in a matter of seconds. That's pretty dramatic.
Kundi says in addition to the pain and legacy the country is still dealing with, the disaster also caused some other kinds of change.
It has brought out, I think, a more independent spirit within the Japanese people and a more questioning spirit and a thought of, what do I really want out of the time I'm allotted here?
Kundi says this represents a major shift in attitude. The generation that's in its 70s now was born during a difficult time after World War II.
And, you know, you hear stories from these people about when they were children eating dirt because they had nothing, of course, as they were rebuilding. So really, everything for them was about how you built the country up. Everything was about our united good.
But he says now some advertisers are aiming more for bucket list and using a classic marketing strategy.
You don't want to give people a mirror. You want to give them a magnet. And, you know, if you're a 70-year-old and you've got full health, do you want to watch, you know, lots of old people sticking stuff to the roof of their mouths? No. You want to see someone getting on a Harley Davidson tearing up the street because you couldn't do it before.
But Japan seniors can now. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is trying to figure out its place on the space-time continuum. As part of an economic development bill that Governor Charlie Baker signed a couple of weeks ago, the Bay State is going to study changing the time zone that it's in because, lo and behold, in the wintertime in the greater Northeast, it gets dark and cold really early. There's going to be a legislative commission set up to study the idea of moving Massachusetts, figuratively anyway, one time zone to the east to the Atlantic time zone. Interestingly enough, the government agency that has to approve any request to change time zones, anybody know? The Department of Transportation. Clearly, I'm the only one who thought that was interesting, the Department of Transportation thing. All right, the Dow up 107 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ added 13 points, a quarter percent. S&P 500, 11 points on the upside, a half of 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.